Good morning. Give people another minute or so to find some seats, then we'll get started. Good morning. My name is Rob Curry, and as chairperson of the Predictive Modeling Seminar Planning Committee, I'd like to welcome you to the fourth annual Predictive Modeling Seminar. We have a very full program for you with an exciting general session speaker who I'll be introducing to you in a moment. We have 30 concurrent sessions for you to choose from, covering numerous topics, generalized linear modeling, different line of business sessions, pricing optimization, sessions on credit scoring. Unfortunately, you will not see any sessions on the use of predictive modeling in Texas Hold'em or in roulette. The planning committee did not feel those sessions would have qualified for continuing education credit, so they didn't make the cut. But feel free to test some of your theories in the real world while you're here in Vegas, and let us know how it works out. As with any CAS meeting or seminar, there are numerous CAS volunteers who work behind the scenes to bring this together for you, and I'd like to recognize those individuals at this time. Members of the Predictive Modeling Seminar Planning Committee, none who are here, I'm not sure what that says about it, but still want to recognize them in their absence. Daniel Blau, Kayleen Arquette, and Khan Zhang are full members of the committee. The planning committee for the predictive modeling seminar is a little unique in that we also have several invited guests to the committee, people who have expertise in the predictive modeling seminar, predictive modeling field, and they gave us invaluable input to this seminar. And that group includes Chuck Bocek, Louise Francis, Jim Gusha, Sarah Guvin, Rob Walling, Duncan Anderson, and Gaetan Veyu. And another major group that helps with the CAS meetings, obviously, is the CAS office staff. And I'd like to give a particular thanks to Kathleen Dean, Leanne Wasorek, and Carrie Smith for helping us stay on track and put this seminar together for you. And also, I'd like to make a special mention of the previous chairperson for this committee, Ron Kozlowski. He was the chairperson for the first three predictive modeling seminars, and it really was his vision and energy that I think made those seminars so successful and really made my job pretty easy taking over for him, and I'm hoping this seminar continues the tradition of the first three. Before introducing our general session speaker, I did just want to mention briefly the new continuing education requirements recently adopted by the American Academy. If you're not already familiar with them, you should familiarize yourself with them because the requirements are now need to be followed by any actuary who issues a statement of actuarial opinion. And I won't give you the actual definition now. You can read it in the actual guidelines. But the expectation is that statement is broad enough that pretty much every CAS member will probably now be required to adhere to these continuing education requirements. And the requirements call for 24 hours of continuing education in 2008 and 30 hours in 2009. So again, be sure to familiarize yourself with those. And now I'm very pleased to introduce to you our general session speaker. Dr. John Elder heads a data mining consulting team with offices in Charlottesville, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Founded in 1995, Elder Research focuses on scientific and commercial applications of pattern discovery and optimization, including stock selection, image recognition, medical text mining, biometric identification, credit scoring, cross-selling, investment timing, and fraud detection. John obtained a BS and an MME in electrical engineering from Rice University, and a PhD in system engineering from the University of Virginia, where he's recently been an adjunct professor teaching optimization. Prior to a decade leading ERI, he spent 5 years in aerospace defense consulting, 4 years heading research at an investment management firm, and 2 years in Rice's Computational and Applied Mathematics Department. Dr. Elder has authored innovative data mining tools, is active in statistics, engineering, and finance conferences and boards, and is a frequent keynote conference speaker. And he will be the general chair of the 2009 Knowledge Discovery and Data Mining Conference in Paris. John's courses on data analysis techniques taught at dozens of universities, companies, and government labs are noted for their clarity and effectiveness. Dr. Elder was honored to serve 5 years on a panel appointed by the President to guide technology for the National Security Agency. John is a follower of Christ and a proud father of five. Please join me in welcoming Dr. John Elder.
Well, it's very kind of you to have me here. It's an honor to speak to the group and to have an opportunity to learn more about actuarial science. I'm a statistician wannabe. I'm an engineer by training. Never took a statistics course before writing my first data mining tool. Now, that's a mistake. But, you know, I've kind of learned through the school of hard knocks. And when you do that and then go back to real school is really fun because you know exactly what you want to learn. And data mining is just a fascinating field. Now, data mining is often accused of the definition being torturing the data until it confesses. So I think that's often very true. And so I want to focus, you know, there's a lot of focuses on best practices. I want to focus today on the flip side, worst practices, many of which I have done and my colleagues have done. And so we're going to be kind of bringing them to light and obviously there's a flip side rule there to follow. But data mining is very, very powerful, but it also is very dangerous if you do it, if you believe it and do it wrong. You do something wrong and you believe it, and we are like artists. We fall in love with our models, don't we? So we have to be really careful to guard against that. So let me talk today about the main ways that you can go wrong, and I'd love to hear stories from y'all here. I'll be here for the conference the whole time. And also at the end of my talk, there'll be there's a microphone there in the middle if folks want to come up and ask questions or make comments. We'll leave time for that. So I'll dive in. Also, for those of you watching your watch, I'll warn you ahead of time, there's not a linear extrapolation. So one-fifth of the way through the talk, or one-half of the way through the talk, I might be only one-fifth of the way through the 10 items, but they get quicker at the end, so don't despair. All right. So here are my opinion about the top 10 ways to go wrong. So you make a mistake if you're building a model from data, if you're inducing relationships from the data, and you actually lack data. So wonderful explanations, the right kinds of data you need. If you focus too much on the training process, and I don't know if you have a laser pointer, I forgot to bring one today, but that, if we have somebody with one, that would help. Obviously, what you want your models to live out in the real world. You want them to work on new data that's like the training data, but isn't the training data. And you'd be astonished at how often we over-focus on the data that we know the answer to and miss the point. It's a mistake also to rely on a single technique. There's a saying that for a little boy with a hammer, all the world is a nail. And anybody here has had a little boy or has been a little boy knows that, you know, the cat looks like a nail, the table looks like a nail. You know, there's a lot of things that that hammer looks like it'll be good for. And how many of us are guilty of being expert with one method and seeing that method as applying to everything? So it's a mistake to ask the wrong question of the data. And there are a couple of different ways there to either have the wrong project goal or the wrong model goal. And by the way, my email, I'll give you now because you can ask me for a copy of this if you want to not be scrambling with note-taking, but elder@datamininglab.com, and I'll send you a PDF. Thank you very much. It's a mistake to listen only to the data. Now, this is a subtle one because the whole point of data mining is to learn from the data and not have our preconceived notions dominate the discussion. but it is an exchange, a back and forth. We need to listen to the data, but we also need to bring in external information and domain expertise. It's a mistake to accept leaks from the future. This is allowing something in the data that wasn't known at the time of decision to enter into your equations, and this happens all the time. I'll give a few examples. Number seven, discounting pesky cases. You see an outlier, you see a problem case, it's tempting to get rid of it, but it could be the answer, not just a problem. So you have to handle them very carefully. Now, number eight, there's a lot of ways to extrapolate or go beyond the evidence into making some kind of conclusion, and this occurs both on the predictive modeling details, but also in ascribing to the new algorithms, believing some of their hype and extrapolating from some of the vocabulary used to describe things. So now it's a mistake to actually answer every inquiry. There should be some cases for which you don't know. The uncertainty, in other words, should be dependent on the question and not just a global uncertainty. Like, I know this answer plus or minus 5. Some cases it is plus or minus 5, some it's plus or minus 1, some it's plus or minus 30. And a better answer would be don't know. So allow that is usually a good idea. Don't feel compelled to answer every problem. Find out if the problem can stand an occasional I don't know. And lastly, it's a mistake to actually believe your model. So that's a little controversial, but we'll show what I mean by that. Now, here's data mining in its purest sense. You know, you're looking into this cloudy Palantir, the things that may or may not happen, and typically you're dominated by noise. There's so much smoke and stuff going on there that the lessons learned may actually be harmful to you if you overdo it. So overfit is the biggest problem. This is also, unfortunately, a picture of data mining training. It's an apprenticeship nowadays that takes a few years, but if you've got a statistical background, that's the strongest protection against doing things wrong. All right, mistake number one. You need labeled cases. You need cases where you have the answer, sort of like a textbook with problems in the back where the odd-numbered problems are solved and have answers. And from that, if you study those cases, you can induce the general rules that will apply to similar but new cases. Now, if you overdo it, if you memorize the answers, if you will, you'll only be able to answer questions that are extremely similar to the ones that were known ahead of time. So you want to connect the dots. And all of data mining depends on some kind of smoothness assumption. In other words, that if you change the input values a little bit, the output values are likely to change a little bit. So you need those output values. Now, if you don't have enough of them, for instance, if you're trying to discover fraud and you don't have enough fraud, you may not be able to use so-called supervised techniques that require the labels on the outputs. So you may have to resort to unsupervised techniques, which are a black hole and very difficult to get out of. But there are some possibilities. Now, I'll give an example. We did a project for the Government Accounting Service in Monterey on contractor fraud. There was the assumption that there must be a lot of people, with all the government contracts out there must be a lot of people defrauding the government. Now, we offered to introduce some training examples with our own. No, but they didn't like that idea, yes. But anyway, they had only about 12 known examples of fraud, however, out of tens of thousands of contracts. Now, 11 of those 12 examples were government employees who had turned themselves in. So these were government employees who had found that if you stayed under a certain limit and had a P.O. box, you know, they created a copy of something, changed a little something, it stayed within bounds, and got some money sent to a P.O. box to help their kid go to college or something, and they were going to pay it back. They were. But where do you pay it back? You know, where's the account? How do you do that? So, you know, if that's your training database, you at best can build a model who will find, you know, guilty government employees with a conscience, right? Because that's your training database. There was one person who didn't turn themselves in. It was a clerk who drove a different sports car to work every day of the month. So they were found. But that took strenuous effort to go from those few known cases to look for any kind of similar sorts of things and to slowly bootstrap up. But it did a wonderful thing that data mining is very good at in terms of the needle in the haystack problem of getting rid of at least 90% of the hay with virtually no needles in that hay. So you could focus the person's attention on the cases that were most likely. So that's one of the key strengths of data mining. But there was another fraud with government related to a tax issue, a kind of a earned income credit, a half welfare problem. And there, unfortunately for the government, there were a lot of fraudulent cases, but that was fortunate for data mining because data mining was able to gain traction and produce tremendous results, magnifying the effectiveness of the top people who are investigating things by over an order of magnitude. So the many known cases really help. So you've got to have data. Now, a company that did some credit scoring is known for its credit scoring skill wanted to look for people who you might say euphemistically were underserved by credit. So this is when they were pushing the boundaries of who might get credit. And they realized that those folks that didn't have a permanent address or didn't have a checking account had never made it through their screen. So they really had no data on these folks. So they went out and invested $2 million to give credit almost randomly to people that met these criteria, small amounts of credit, over a two-year period, and build up a database that was appropriate to the question they were asking. So that was a very good project. Now, credit scoring is a scary thing because your best customers, you like customers who pay off their debt, but your best customers are those who can't pay it off but keep trying. So you have this sort of risk return, you know, gets better, but then if things are a little worse, you go off a cliff, and those customers are seven times worse than had you never talked to them in the first place. So credit scoring is kind of like that triage problem that was invented back when Napoleon was running all over Europe and armies, levy en masse, the armies were bigger than they'd ever seen before, and cannons were decimating people. They had to break people into three groups, you know, mildly injured, where you could wait for attention, more seriously injured but recoverable, where you needed attention right away and it would actually be good for the army, and then you're too bad off. We won't waste our resources on you. So you can imagine someone out on the battlefield, "What? It was just a flesh wound," you know. So anyway, so credit scoring is like that. You've got that return. As the risk gets higher and higher, the return's better, and then all of a sudden it goes off a cliff. And unfortunately, your models might model that situation, and you might figure that threshold out, and then the economy will change under you, you know, and move the whole distribution across sort of an invisible threshold, and you've got a worse, much worse result than you anticipated. So know your data, make sure you have it, and then remember that there's economic cycles as well. All right. It's a mistake to focus solely on training. You know, if you out-of-sample results are all that matter. If you wanted to just grow on training results, just keep a table of your results, a lookup table. When at Rice, across the street at MD Anderson, one of these great medical centers, they were a bunch of doctors gathered to review some results from neural networks. Now, neural networks were big. This is more than 10 years ago. They were especially hyped then. I'm actually a reluctant fan of neural networks. I found they work pretty well, but not for the reasons their proponents say. But you'll find that neural networks play a role in many of these mistakes that I'm bringing to light. I think it's because people overbelieve the hype and don't use common sense checking. But anyway, they trained the neural net for a day and got a certain performance result and then tried it out of sample. So they followed this correctly. They used out of sample results, and it was worse. In a way that was unacceptable. So they said, well, let's train it for a week. And they got better training results. But what happened to the out-of-sample results? Anybody guess? They got worse. And they were astonished by this. All right. Now, we shouldn't be astonished by this. We're statisticians. We know that overfit is possible and that you're connecting some dots. The line can get a little crazy if you overdo it. But if you think about it from a medical person's standpoint, what do they do to solve every problem? If somebody needs to learn something, a person, they just train them longer or make them not sleep or whatever. You know, they get more hours out of them, more hours into them, and that builds up their experience and they get better. It'd be inconceivable for a human doctor to get worse after a week of training on something compared to what they could do with a day. So there they were extrapolating, again, the neural network, thinking of it as a little brain and extrapolating to the human experience, and it doesn't work that way. So anyway, you got to have your testing procedures built in from the beginning. And a lot of people in the past, especially in the machine learning or computer science arena, who are entering into the statistical world aren't aware of that, and they often try to build their models to have zero error on the training data. So the best protection against all this is a fascinating technology called resampling, which involves leave-one-out testing, cross-validation, bootstrapping, jackknife. It comes by lots of different names, but the basic idea there is to, you could get lucky if you split the data, train and test, you could get lucky or unlucky. So do it multiple times with different partitionings and get a distribution of results. When I teach my data mining courses, I say if there's any one thing I want you to learn when you come out of this course, it's about this idea of resampling. So that I think would be a great session for a future conference here, the uses of it, and I expect to see it in a number of the talks that folks are giving. All right, so to rely on a single technique, it's best at the very least to compare your new method that you're introducing to a conventional method. Now, that seems like common sense, and it's a good thing to do. But in a refereed journals, a person does a study over a 3-year period in neural network journals. Now, journals obviously have peer review, so it's a harder threshold to get into them than conference papers and so forth. So you can imagine the problem getting much, much worse as you go down the chain. But in refereed journal articles, only one out of six of the articles did number one and two right. Remember, number one was out of sample data, report results on new data that the model has never seen before. And number two is try it against a conventional technique. So really a minimum is a 2x2 table where you have, you know, the old and busted technique versus the new hotness, and you have the training data versus the evaluation data. And only one out of six of the articles in the journals had that minimal amount of information. So it's gotten better since then, but you know, these are very widely made mistakes. Now, if you don't check other methods, if you don't try conventional linear regression and things like that, you're going to think that the performance is due to the algorithm. It's very natural for us to put a lot of weight on whether someone's using a decision tree or a neural network or so forth. Now, with the possible exception of decision trees, which are wonderful except they're the least accurate of all the major methods, almost all the methods when used by a proponent, and even decision trees when you bundle them together and create multiple trees, almost all of them by somebody who knows what they're doing can get in the same ballpark as far as performance. So the real difference between problems is how hard the problem innately is. And so I've seen multiple examples of people, you know, getting great results on a problem and assuming it's their wonderful algorithm when really it's just the nature of the problem is a relatively easy one. So it's best to use a handful of good tools. So don't just have a hammer, have that screwdriver and the saw and other things in your toolbox. Now, the good news there is if you build two or three or four different models, there's two terrific things that come out of it. Number one, it looks like you've done three or four times the amount of work, but really each one only adds about 5 or 10% of the effort once you've done all the hard work of getting the data in the right shape and asking the right problems of the data and understanding it and so forth. So as a consultant or as an employee, your productivity appearance is much greater. All right, so that's number one, and you always have to worry about that. Number two, though, you actually can get better results if you have multiple modeling methods. And we'll look at that. The very, very hot area right now is the whole idea of ensembling different models together, that a committee of models is better than an individual one. And I've got a journal article on my website about that if you want. Well, data mining products, the wonderful thing about using multiple methods is there's a lot of wonderful software out there to help us do it and to do it well. And even some good training to go with it and so forth. So here's just a splash page of some of the more popular data mining softwares out there. You notice I've included languages like SAS and SPSS and R and so forth at the bottom there if you really want to build things yourself. Weka is a completely free tool that's pretty good. It's not fast. It can't handle large data sets, but the things have been done well. The market leader is SAS's Enterprise Miner, followed closely by SPSS's Clementine, and then Fair Isaac has a good tool. Now, I don't know what the price is now, but I know that IBM's Intelligent Miner for Data used to be $300,000. So, you know, some of these are definitely over, this is over 100, near 100, up in that same ballpark. So these are humongously expensive tools for the largest, most complex suites. But some of these others are much more affordable and focused. Actually, we have all of these tools and use them regularly at Elder Research. So we've been delighted to see in the progress that has been made in a very competitive market. So the tools are getting better all the time. Now, inside the tools, there really aren't that many different algorithms. The most popular nonlinear algorithm is decision trees. Make sure you know decision trees. They can be used often when other ones can't, even unless you're really good at regression. The decision trees have wonderful properties. But they build the world up like a Manhattan skyline, where you have sharp thresholds and piecewise constants, and that doesn't often fit the world as well as one relaxation of that is to use a nearest neighbor technique, where it's kind of like an unethical student in junior high looking at their nearest neighbor to get the answer. You would find a case that's known that is most similar to the case you're interested in and take that answer as your prediction. And that builds up, if you're using the single nearest neighbor, that builds up these piecewise constant boundaries that aren't north, south, east, west like they are one variable at a time with the decision trees. So, but both of them have those sharp cutoffs, and smoother methods are typically better, like polynomial networks or neural networks. They have differentiable nonlinear surfaces that connect the dots. Here we have two inputs, the X and Y, and then the output is the Z, the surface. Kernel methods are very useful, not so sexy because they've been in the statistics world for a long time, but if you have low-dimensional data, it's a great way to generate a conditional probability distribution for accidents versus non-accidents or so forth, and very fruitful for answering questions. And then other methods that do piecewise planar connections. Well, which of these methods is best? It's a very common and very good and very important question. Here's a study that Stephen Lee at the University of Idaho and I did a decade ago comparing five of the different algorithms that we could get a hold of easily and knew how to use. I think we used the S-plus language for this study, and six different well-studied problems. So the six problems are, now what we've shown, I'll explain them in a minute, but the error is relative. So the one that did the best on the Pima Indian diabetes was logistic regression. But logistic regression did worst on this, what turns out to be a made-up investment problem. Now these six problems appear in the University of California Irvine Machine Learning Data Repository, which is a great place to run and get data and try your new techniques out on. The problem is, one of the problems is, these six problems have had more papers written using them, and there are another several dozen, than there are data points in the data set. So they're pretty well-worked problems, but it gives you a literature to compare against. Now, in a bake-off like this, you want to have proponents of the techniques working each one, and so we did. You see that, so if you had to choose a single one, which of those appears at the bottom most often? Neural networks, that's right. So neural networks does second to worst on the Pima Indians data, but wins, or almost wins, on all the rest. Now, as it turns out, though, there's a Miss Congeniality Award for every one of the algorithms, because every one of them comes in first or second, if you count ties, on at least two of the six problems. So every dog has its day. Now, I actually used that phrase in a conference down in Santiago, Chile, when and a translator said something different. And I asked later, the translator did an awesome job. I don't know how anyone can translate free form, full speed, but something weird came out when I said that. So afterwards, I asked her, what did you say? When I said, well, I made it culturally relevant. I said, tell the pig Christmas is coming. So, well, you know, every dog has his day. So it turns out that, you know, pig, you think you're something, your dinner, Christmas, you know. So it was kind of the flip side version of it. Yeah, you know, because estimates. And if a classification, you turn it into a number between 0 and 1, not a hard 0 or 1, and average them together, you get this result right here. Now, when Stephen Lee and I were writing this paper, we were trying to introduce a new way to do ensembling, which was this red one called advisor perceptrons, which was, you know, we were excited about and had a neat theory behind it. And that was our first result. Like anyone, we tried, as soon as we got the individual results, we tried the advisor perceptrons, and we got this terrific result, this red result that compares to, you know, beats the best of the individual methods. So we're very excited. Then Stephen Lee said, John, follow your own advice. Try a simpler method of combining. So that's where we came back down to earth, and we saw that, you know, just averaging. Yes, it beat averaging in every case, but not by much. And then other methods like voting turn everything into a 0-1. You have to tell me a decision. You can't tell me 30%. You have to say 0 or 1. You do that to each of the algorithms and then take the plurality vote if a don't know is not allowed, or a majority vote if that is allowed. I said that backwards. Take a majority vote or a plurality vote, whichever is appropriate, and you do it just as well. So these simple ensemble methods did as well as our complex new ensemble method, which was a disappointment for the person introducing something, but is a great encouragement for any of us actually practicing. We can get this ensemble thing pretty cheaply. Now, there are fancy new ways of doing ensembling, and I gave a tutorial on that in August. It's available on the web if you go to our website. Video tutorial with a fellow named Giovanni Sine out in California. So if you want to see some of the newer ways of doing things that take it another step and are much harder to implement, that information is out there, and it's very much on the cutting edge right now. All righty. So that was mistake number 3, was to just use one method. That was a long one. But ensembling is a real breakthrough. I encourage everyone to try. All right. Mistake number 4 is now to ask the wrong question of the data. So there are a couple of ways here to look at it, the project goal or the model goal. Are you aiming at the right target? Let me give an example of someone who did something unconventionally, but it was a great idea. Bell Labs, years ago, was fighting the problem of working on long-distance fraud. And there are lots of ways fraudsters would cheat Ma Bell of money, including putting alligator clips on a line outside the house and charging people money to come up and call all day long, or stealing a pin number or something like that. And so the idea was to try to put a hurdle in front of the most suspicious cases. Now, normally when you're faced with a classification problem like fraud, non-fraud, you take a sample of fraudulent cases and a sample of non-fraud, and you usually have to either boost the fraudulent to make them competitive in number, or more likely, or simultaneously, you know, subsample from the non-fraudulent cases. Now, there are 100 million different customers that they had, or phone lines that they had to track. Just a few samples from each one would have been crazy. So instead, they reworked the problem. They aimed at a better target and said, let's characterize from the billing data what is normal for a call for one phone. In other words, if it's a business phone with an office, there'll be a lot of short calls during the day. If it's a residential phone, there might be a longer call, more on the weekends when things were cheaper, or nights and so forth. And they created a lot of features of what was normal, and also created a way to have that migrate slowly over time so that it wouldn't be fixed in stone, but would allow for changes in the behavior of the population that's using that phone. And they had a tremendous success. They had to build their own language to do this on such a massive scale of 100 million different models, 100 million different phones, and they had to pare it down to just the right features, which took but 4 people, part-time for a year, built this system and implemented it. And in the first year, they saved Bell Labs enough money to fund the entire Shannon Research Labs of 400 people. So if you think about it, as 100-to-1 or 200-to-1 return on investment in year one. So that's a great example of data mining. And again, it wasn't a fraud, no-fraud model that they built. They instead said, what's characterized as normal behavior? So I use it as an example of getting the right project goal, looking at the characteristics of the problem, and thinking about that. The business problem is extremely important. Now you get down to where you want to build a model. Are you using the right score function for that model? Are you using the right metric or thing that you're trying to optimize. That's one of the key things about optimization. So you want the computer as much as possible to feel like you do. A counterexample to this is using employee stock options to make an employee, a key employee, feel like an owner and behave like an owner and have the owner's interests at heart. That's not a good idea. Better would be a stock grant to make them actually an owner, because an option actually rewards risk. If you think about it, the option is worth nothing if the company tanks or putzes along, and the option takes huge value if the company does well. So it's entirely rational for the key decision maker to roll the dice and bet big to individually win on that payoff, which is not the way it is for the owner. The owners experience a gain or a loss, whereas the key employee would only experience one way. So you have to think, am I incentivizing the right kind of behavior with my metrics? And that's the same as with the computer. The computer is brilliant in its own way and very, very stupid in all the other ways. My family loves to tell a story on me. In third grade, Dad was off in Vietnam. Mom wanted help with dinner. Imagine Dad probably wouldn't help with dinner even if he was home. But anyway, so she used my brother and me for slave labor, but we'd like to eat, so that was good. So she said, take some potatoes, wash them, stick them with a fork, put them in the oven, 400 degrees. But Mom, no buts, just go do it. And then 10 minutes later, she's thinking, oh my gosh, and runs in there. And sure enough, in the oven, three potatoes with a fork in each one, you know, and the fork is bubbling away. And she saved them to this day because they have little moon craters on them, and that was the year of the moon landing. So the grandkids love the moon forks. But anyway, that's the computer. It does what you say. It has no common sense. So you have to give it common sense. You have to give it a score metric that is similar to yours. Now, I want to give an example with stock prices, because that's something near and dear to our heart, probably our largest area of business is in helping hedge funds and so forth build models and evaluate models and evaluate risk and so forth. But let's say you use squared error, because the math is beautiful. I mean, the math is so beautiful for squared error that people will use it when it's completely inappropriate. It's like a drunk looking for their keys under the lamppost outside because the light's better there. Well, they probably lost them inside, you know, we're at the bar, but the light isn't as good there. So anyway, we got to use a metric. It's best to use a metric that's appropriate. Now, if you think about predicting stock prices, and you build your model, and you say, okay, I'm going to predict for my employee 401k program whether I should buy the stock or not, and you predict that it's going to go from $10 to $11 over the next quarter, well, what do you do with that information? Oh, you got a model, you trust your model. It's 10% gain in a quarter. Is that a good thing? Okay, it is. Now, it's conceivable that there'll be other opportunities out there that are better. But for now, let's just say, and you always want to look at relative performance. But, okay, absolute performance of 10% in a quarter is terrific. So you buy. Now, it actually turns out that things are much better than you thought. And instead of $11, it's $14 a quarter later. So you've made 40%. How do you feel? You feel great, except, gosh, why didn't I mortgage the house and put more in? You know, so you never feel good with the stock market. There's always a way to kick yourself. But anyway, you do feel great. You made the right decision, and it was much better than you expected. Now, how does the computer feel? Now, when you plug in the new data and update your model, it thought 11. Truth was 14. What's your squared error? 9, right? It's kicking itself. Oh, I'm such a bad computer. I should change my weights to get that closer next time. Okay, now let's say instead, alternate scenario, you know, bad news. It went from 10 down to 9 instead. You lost 10% instead of gaining so much. You feel bad. How does the computer feel about that 9? It predicted 11, it got a 9. It's got a squared error of 4. It's twice as happy with that result. More than twice as happy with an error of 4 as opposed to an error of 9. So you and the computer just aren't thinking alike. So you've got to get that computer to reward you for making the right decision, even if it gets the magnitude wrong. And you build a customized error metric for that. And, of course, that complicates your model search procedure. But it can pay off. And that's where some of the edge comes, is getting that score function right. Okay, so ask the right question. Focus on the right model goal. Mistake number 5. to listen only to the data. You know, we're trying to learn from the data. We're trying to let it speak. We're trying to let it overcome and overpower our preconceived hidebound notions, right? Well, it's best if you have both, if you bring in the expertise from the domain and not just pay attention to the data. Let me show an example of data that I typed in from a newsletter. Now, we were homeschoolers for years, and this newsletter was saying how silly it was to throw money at the public schools. We have kids in public schools and private schools and now. How silly it was to throw money at the public schools given the results. So how can you measure the results? Well, they used a metric of average SAT scores. So the SAT ranking is here. So Nevada had a ranking of 29th in the country of the states and spent, and this is over a decade ago, spent about $4,500 per high school student. And in New Mexico, nearby, ranked better and spent about the same amount. But surely there's got to be a link between spending. And if you build I'm using a tool called DataDesk, which is a handy tool here. If you calculate a regression between spending, SAT ranking and spending, you get a result that there is a very strong relationship between them that has a T ratio of 4 and a probability of only 1 in 10,000 that it could have risen by chance. And it's only got an R-squared of 26%, so it's not a great fit. But if you get an R-squared of 3% in the stock market, you can make money. So, you know, don't have your standards too high. But let's instead plot this, because plotting is so much better. Let's see. I want to do a scatter plot. All right, so here's the relationship between SAT. Oops, it went a little large. Let me do it again. All right, so the relationship between spending and SAT scores. And if we build our regression line, we see visually the line that we saw in the equation. So you can see there is a strong trend here. And we might argue over what better model. You know, there seems to be variance maybe changing at time. Maybe a nonlinear model would work better. Maybe we need to normalize for cost of living, so forth. But there's an undeniably strong trend here. So the governor asked us, you know, well, how much should we spend here in bring the state to the fore, and now if we click on something, it'll tell us the state. Okay, so we're in Virginia, and the ones that spend the most are New Jersey, New York, and D.C. But so the question is, you know, we're in Virginia, we want to spend more. How much will that help us? And you run the numbers, and you say, well, if we were able to add another 1,000 to the spending, then we would rise in the ranks. Oh, wait a minute. Rising in the ranks is a bad thing. Being ranked 50th is bad. So we need to take money away from those students to get better. Maybe we need to follow some of the things that are being done by these awesome states here, Iowa and Minnesota, Idaho, South Dakota, Utah, Nebraska. So at the time that I was analyzing this data, we were also working on a problem to predict sales of corn hybrids. And it turns out the corn-eating states do really well. So that's probably the secret, the corn-producing states. So anyway, what is going on here? We could analyze this data. We could look at all sorts of statistical things. But there's this undeniably strong trend that is the exact opposite of what we thought it would be, that spending hurts, apparently. Or maybe things are so bad they keep throwing money at it. Maybe it's a cause and effect reversal, but the money doesn't do any good, so they stay bad. But in any case, our statistics are not going to help us at all here. All the data that we have is going to confirm this result. In fact, when we break the data into two subsets, whether they have a National Association of Educational Professionals ranking or not, and we build regression lines on those two subjects, this is phenomenal. The two subsets of data had the exact same slope. It's just phenomenal, just a slightly different constant. So this trend can't be taken out of the data. But what is going on? What is the secret to why these states down here are doing well, besides corn producing? Tennessee, Oklahoma. Does anybody have an idea? Cost of living? Could be, yeah. Maybe we could adjust for that. But I think that only makes a small adjustment. Yes, sir? That's exactly the answer right there. The ACT is the test that a lot of these states that are doing well take. So who is taking the SAT in Iowa? The smart kids that want to pay extra money and spend three hours extra on a Saturday morning taking this test to possibly go out of state to one of the coastal schools or something. So it's a self-selection bias problem. Your metric was wrong. You were saying, what is the average of all the students who take the SAT in that state? And we're going to rank the state by that. That information has to come from outside the data. It's not in the data. So this is a great example of where you need to bring external information in, or you'll make the wrong decision. By the way, the state schools that you can get into are the greatest bargain in America as far as value per dollar. It's incredible. So only idiots or smart people would go out of state. Anyway, so listening to the data, there's another famous example where you're trying to distinguish tanks from non-tanks. This actually occurred with an Army project in a forest. And they took a bunch of data, reserved some of it, so that's a good step. And they had perfect training results. Well, that's not so surprising. You can, using a neural net or something else that's powerful, you can often get perfect training results. But they also did perfectly well on the reserved data that had been set aside. Perfect results. But before fielding it, they got new data, went out and bought new data, and it did terrible on that new data. Well, finally someone figured out that the secret was that all of the data on the first day, the tanks were photographed on a sunny day and the non-tanks on a cloudy day. So the neural net had learned how to distinguish light from dark pixels and had a threshold and said, you know, if it's light, they're tanks. And the problem wasn't with the neural net. The neural net was asked, what is the difference that you can predict repeatedly between this set of data and this set of data? So it had done its job, but the problem was with its experimental design that hadn't taken into account enough factors. And I have another example with tanks and trucks and networks and so forth. And the secret was, well, they had a radar tower set up, and they had a tank, and they were trying to tell the angle of the tank. So they had it on this big Lazy Susan thing, and were moving it around and taking data and using fast Fourier transforms and signal processing and principal component analysis and polynomial networks and all this fancy stuff, and got some answers that were pretty good. But my colleague, who was deep in the thing, was able to figure out that it was picking up on the edge of the platform as the key discriminator of what angle it was, you know. And we just couldn't get the other side to add these platform edges to their tanks. So, to add insult to injury, the difference between tanks and trucks was hypothesized. They didn't have the actual heart to look into it, but it was strongly hypothesized that the difference was that there were bushes next to the tank, the truck. So it was telling whether there were bushes or not. So getting the data and sampling it, even with a designed experiment where you control where the data, is often very hard to do. And most of the time, though, we don't have design experiment. We don't go out and find the people with the right characteristics and see how long they live. We have opportunistic data. We have data that comes at us that we've had no design over at all. And I liken it to making a salad out of weeds you find in the yard. You know, you got limits to what you can do, but you do the best you can. So, but you need information from outside the data. All right. It's a mistake to accept leaks from the future. Fellow with a PhD, a couple of books under his belt, had built a neural network. Again, neural networks are the culprit, for a bank in Chicago to forecast interest rates, and had a 95% accuracy forecasting interest rates. Now, you can imagine how useful that would be. A little too useful. By the way, there's a clue. If you get really, really good results, you know, pay somebody else to break them. You know, you could try to break them, but you want them to work, so you may not be 100% able to do it, but pay somebody else and reward them for breaking it. Very, very valuable thing to do. So the board of the bank actually called in some colleagues of mine, and they looked at it, and they found that one of the inputs, one of the candidate inputs, was the interest rate, the future interest rate that was trying to be. So the neural net only lost 5% of the information as it went through, which was very good. So another example was actually kind of personally painful because I spent weeks reverse engineering this fellow's work. But they had a company, they were flying around PowerPoint. They had 70% accuracy predicting the direction of a major market index for finance. And they were using a fourth generation language, and I had to go out and buy that language in order to try to reproduce some of the results and so forth. And finally I did. I reproduced their results exactly. And the sad thing was, there were two things that were kind of sad about it. One was it was a moving average of three prices. Now, you don't need a fourth generation language to do that. But anyway, but that's okay. You know, simplicity occurs a lot in the markets because there's such noise that if you do things too complex, it can shoot you. You're shooting yourself in the foot with a cannon instead of a gun. So, but the problem was that three-day moving average was centered on today. So they were using yesterday's price, today's price, and tomorrow's price, averaging them together, and they were 70% right in predicting the direction. Now, you could have gotten 100% right if you'd thrown away one of those data points, right? Anyway, I don't think they were deliberately trying to fraud anyone. I think they just had an off-by-one error way back in the early research stages, and then the guys who were marketing it, you know, took it from there. So it's scary what's going on out there. And you need to look, if you get too many good results, you need to look at them. You might need to take many passes through the data, decapitating your best variable after you've inspected it. So one insurance problem that we worked with, this was AAA. So AAA has a large collection of people who subscribe to their service, and then a smaller subset of those that are more valuable who actually buy some of their insurance products. And this is a particular regional AAA, so I can't speak for them globally, but there was this wonderful code that was, if it was had a value at all, the person was absolutely an insurer. We're trying to predict insurers, and we got the data. Here's what we know about this person. What can predict whether they buy the insurance or not? Well, 1/4 of the cases could immediately be explained by this value, the existence of this one code. Well, it's tempting to say, okay, I've got 1/4 of the problem solved. Now let's focus on the hard part. And that's always something you want to do with data mining is, you know, if you can solve an easy part of the problem and set it aside. The problem was the code was how they canceled their insurance. So, which is obviously not something you know when they haven't got insurance yet. So it was a leak from the future that had been put there. And that happens all the time because databases aren't set up for data mining. They're set up for billing. And you're trying to keep the latest and greatest information about a household. You might have a person that originally was single and no kids, and now they're married and have kids, and you have that information in there. Then you go back and say, well, who are our best customers, or who bought our policies? Well, they didn't buy it when they were in their current state. They bought it in an earlier state, and that's when you want the as-of data. And that happens in the stock market all the time, a survivor bias. Just ask the example of, well, you know, the internet companies are doing pretty well. What if I look at all the internet companies and I go back and say, you know, yeah, they went through that crash, but they came back through it, some of them. And so you go to the data set and you define internet companies, Yahoo, Google, you know, eBay, and all those guys. And you go back and you say, wow, they would have been a good investment. I'll stick with it next time when it goes through the crash. I won't worry about overvaluation because, anyway, what did you just do? You went to a data source. You found all existing surviving internet companies and looked at their history. You didn't look what was available at the time and all those that crashed and burned and aren't in the database anymore. It's very rare for a stock database to have any past information about a company that's not available now because they're usually trying to sell services based around what they can do now in terms of trades and so forth. So survivor bias, big problem. It's like interviewing folks who made it through the war and say, oh, it wasn't that bad, you know. Anyway, so, all righty. Pesky cases. Your outliers could be killing your results. You could have a decimal error off or something, and it could blow your whole model great examples of outliers that just dominate, have huge influence over the model that they shouldn't have. So, but they could also be the answer or be the result. So you need to look at them carefully and not have a one-size-fits-all way of dealing with outliers. An example was the information about the ozone hole over the Antarctic, I believe it is, was there in the data for years, where you have ozone levels being measured, then bang, there's this thing that's maximized out to the number of bits that the instrument can have, and they always just kind of, you know, something's wrong with this guy, let's replace it. For years it was in the data until someone found that it was a real result. So there's a Tolstoy expression, I think, that starts off either War and Peace or Anna Karenina, that says, all happy families are alike. Unhappy families are unhappy in their own way, you know. So that's useful for the outliers. The outliers are outliers in different ways and worth examining. The most exciting phrase in research isn't Eureka, where you run around. Well, maybe it's exciting if you run around like Archimedes and naked out in the public square. But anyway, it's not usually that. It's, that's odd. You know, there's something that didn't meet expectations. And so, as a rule, have expectations for your results. Be surprised when the school funding has you improving quality by taking money away and so forth. Now, let's think back to that. Had the relationship been the other way around, would we have looked at the data a second time? If we'd shown that the slope was for every $5,000 that you spend, you can move, you know, 10 slots better in the rankings, we wouldn't have examined the data again because it would have met our prior expectations. So we have to be really hard on ourselves in terms of what our prior expectations are, and then we can have these surprises. Look for internal inconsistencies in the data. A really good database is like one we looked at recently where 95% of the husbands were male. That's good, you know. But you might want to look at the ones where they aren't, you know, and maybe some other, anything you can check you might want to look at. In a direct mail problem that we worked on for a client, they were able to double their sales per catalog, partly due to some of our findings, one of which was that inconsistencies in how often people were receiving catalogs led to realizing that the merge purge house, which was putting the names together and taking off these and putting them, had incorrectly put international customers in the purge bin. And so we're excluding them from promotional catalogs, and these customers were ordering from memory or from, you know, the catalog that was included with their last order. They were really robust customers, so that helped a lot when they were no longer purged. But, you know, it was so obvious what should have been done that no one had ever checked it until looking for these internal inconsistencies. And visualization is very handy here for covering a lot of assumptions. Just, and be brave to ask questions. I think we were cussed at the third time we asked about this merge-purge issue, but, you know, we persevered and it helped the client. Well, extrapolation, we're getting there to the end. extrapolation, and what I mean by this is somewhat philosophical as well as practical. Two problems that kind of hurt you in research is you tend to learn too much from your first few experiences. For instance, I was playing simulated blackjack last night to get ready for the real thing. Although, frankly, that's a pretty interesting problem because the rules are different at each of the different tables, and that changes the probabilities and so forth. But in there, I had a pair of aces on one of the hands, which I was, you know, very excited about and going to split, and the dealer was showing an ace. Now, when they show an ace, you have this bad bet option of buying insurance that pays off 2-1. It was less than 2-1 probability that they have a 10 underneath, so it's a bad bet individually. But the dealer had blackjack when I had the pair of aces, you know. And so what did I learn? Oh, buy insurance if I have a pair of aces because it's too painful to not split the pair of aces. And maybe that is a good lesson to learn. I haven't actually worked through the probabilities, but that was one sample, okay? Now, that seared into my brain, you know, even though no real money changed hands. But I probably learned too much from that one example. I probably need to examine. And this happens all the time with data mining. You have an early experience or an early case, and that has too much weight, and you tend to look for confirmatory evidence. People have shown that if you're making a decision about a car or something like that really is an emotional decision and you're trying to be rational about it, and it's a multi-variable optimization function. You don't want good cost, good gas mileage. You don't want it to look nice. You want it to be the right color. You tend to make the decision and then use your brain to confirm the decision. So you go out and find confirmatory evidence and ignore evidence to the contrary. So we're researchers, or we're trying to get to the heart of a problem. We've got to fight that human tendency and try to look at evidence, again, plain. But it's very hard to do. And it's also hard to erase factoids, things that you learned that actually were wrong. We do simulations, and inevitably, we typically do them two different ways and make them reconcile. And if you don't reconcile, then there's a bug and you fix it. Some of the things you learned back when the simulation was false is hard to forget. It's hard to forget. There was a great example, a master student working at UVA, University of Virginia, with me, was working on a medical problem, trying to predict the strength of a heart for children, heart strength, trying to do something less invasive than a catheter. So you squeeze the hand and see how quickly the color comes back. You measure the temperature at various extremities and so forth. Things that nurse could do easily to monitor this if a model could be built. So you build data where you have the gold standard, which is this catheter, and you have these other simpler measures. And he had a plot of it, and it was before the PowerPoint ubiquity. So he had it on a transparency, and he ran across the street to the medical center, and the head doctor and the head nurse were looking at it, and he put it down, and they started immediately making conclusions. Oh, look, when the temperature goes up, a heart strength is improved. And then my colleague, to his credit and shame but credit for actually following through, realized he'd put the transparency down upside down, you know. So he turned it over. Well, this just totally reversed the results. But what did the nurse and the doctor do? Oh, that makes sense too. You see, when temperature goes down, we're interpreting machines. We're going to find an explanation for whatever comes out. So we have to guard against that. And one of the best ways to guard against that is to work in a team. Have people question your assumptions. We have one person on our staff who's particularly good at questioning assumptions. She's still working for us, but you know, she's gifted in the devil's advocate area. But that turns out to be really valuable for the team. That kind of extrapolation from early results, extrapolating from low-dimensional results to higher-dimensional results. The curse of dimensionality says that your low-dimensional intuition is useless in high dimensions. In high dimensions, there is no data point near you in space. You're very lonely out there in high-dimensional space. So, again, you might think of an idea that works great on the whiteboard in two dimensions that's just going to have all sorts of problems in higher dimensions. So, and then I have a sort of provocative extrapolation here, a philosophical extrapolation. A lot of data mining techniques are talked about as learning, machine learning, or artificial intelligence, and so forth. So extrapolating kind of beyond the science of what it's actually doing, and that belief sometimes will carry people when the evidence isn't there. So I think the best analogy, the evolutionary analogy is good for data mining, but it's more the microevolution, taking mutts and turning them into dogs, into greyhounds, you know, over several generations of focused breeding, is kind of what you can do with the data. You take this amorphous model and it can select variables and refine parameters and get better, but it's probably not going to do performance equivalent to the inter-species jumps, the macro-evolutionary, going from pond scum to a crawling around critter. So be modest about what you expect from the technologies. Here's kind of an immodest expectation. This was a Time magazine actually more than a decade ago when Kasparov was competing against Deep Blue or Big Blue, the chess master. And Kasparov actually won. Now, Kasparov is supposedly the best human that's ever lived playing chess, as experts have rated. So, yay, humans. Then 3 years later, he lost soundly to the computer. Now, chess seems like a pretty smart thing. But it's actually a pretty easy problem from a computer standpoint because it's a fixed world with finite rules. And the real challenge is how do you trade off the multi-criteria for your score function? Personnel, loss of personnel versus gain of position and so forth. And the way that IBM, who built the automatron, did this was data mining. They built an inductive database of grandmasters facing each other and said, what weights for our decision thing would have led to decisions that most closely matched what the grandmasters chose to do when they played each other. That was very clever. So they had the computer with its strength, able to look at 14 plies or pairs of moves, you know, all exhaustively and score them. And then to get that all-important score function, they induced from the best they had, the gold standard they had, which was the highest level of human play. And then they had special openings and sequences and special end game where the score function changes in the end game and so forth. So they did really well, and even still, Kasparov was able to beat them in the first go-around. So that provoked this article, Can Machines Think? They already do, say scientists, that homogenous band of people. So what, if anything, is special about the human mind? And one MIT computer science professor went so far as to say, of course machines can think. After all, humans are just machines made of meat. So I thought that was the stupidest thing I'd ever seen in print. Anybody who's actually worked with a computer, or worked with a human, we're not machine-like at all, but that would be called the high AI view, or the low human view, I guess, would be another way of looking at it, because we're pretty bad machines. I mean, we have a 10 hertz cycle. I mean, that's pretty slow. The best we can react is a tenth of a second, but we have this massive parallelism going on, and who knows, we may have something beyond that. But we're very different from machines in our known properties, and in all, in my lifetime, we will not see, I don't think, humans doing as well as computers in adding up checkbooks. We won't see computers doing as well in having a conversation. The human and computer strengths are more complementary than alike. A famous AI person was asked back in the 60s how long it would take till they had full duplex translation from one language to another, and he said, 10 years. 10 years, we'll have it down. So 30 years later, he was asked the same question. He said, I see no reason to change my forecast. About 10 years. So anyway. All right, mistake number 9 is it's a mistake to actually answer every inquiry. And I don't mean that in the sense of what happens at Vegas stays in Vegas, although that is appropriate, I guess. But anyway, don't know is a useful model output state. And for this, it's very useful to have, instead of a sort of a global uncertainty, an uncertainty that's case-based. In other words, perhaps a population comes in, and they're not very well represented, so there's a large variance with respect to their performance compared to what's common for the rest of the population. You wouldn't want to lump all the answers together and say we have this much global uncertainty. You'd want to make the uncertainty as specific as possible. So have a conditional sigma as well as a conditioned for doing that involves piecewise planar model fits as your, that's that gray, you have those three known points or the corners, so the points in between them are the planar connection of the three known points, but the uncertainty, the variance is a quadratic expression between those points bounded by the known points. So zero uncertainty at the corners and growing uncertainty in the middle, and you can put that together to create a model that's a piecewise planar fit with uncertainty canopies over top of them, and you can maximize your expected return using both a conditional mean and a conditional sigma. Anyway, very fun technique, but won't go into the details here, but the conditional sigma was the key to that. All right, the last point, which I have a couple slides on, is it's a mistake to actually believe your best model. So in fields that I work in, which is not, I think, the case for most of you all, interpretability is not important. Performance is important. If you can get a slight edge in performance and you have the proper statistical ways of testing the model, you don't need to explain the model. If you can trade futures interactively and it works and you have a lot of data to test it with out of sample, who cares exactly why it works? Okay, I'm sort of overstating because everyone always cares, but interpretability is not necessarily needed. I think it's usually a virtue, but it's not needed. Now, other places, when you're trying to explain credit scores or insurance, you have to be able to explain why someone was rejected, and you have to have interpretability, and that constrains your performance. But make sure you're not using interpretability as a constraint when it's not needed. So models can be useful without being correct or explanatory. I mean, the Egyptians used to think that the dog star Sirius caused the flooding of the Nile, the nutting of the flyle. And it, of course, as far as we know, didn't cause it, but it was a great early indicator, a great predictor. It was useful for them, even though it wasn't explanatory or causal. Now, when you're building models with data mining, you typically build billions of possible models. You look at lots and lots of possibilities, and you're pulling out the best from this vast search. Now, this is an extreme danger of overfit. You know, if I said, looking at U.S. demographics, the probability that someone here is, that an individual that I'm talking to is over 6 foot three would be a low probability on the tail end of the distribution. But if I surveyed this entire audience, the probability goes way up. That the best, tallest person in this audience, best by that metric, would be over. You need a new distribution for the best of a vast search. And you can't use the old metrics and the old ways of adjusting for R-squared and so forth. So you really need a resampling. So when you build models that have looked at lots of different possibilities, so the particular variables they picked up on are almost random in some cases because there are other very correlated variables it could have used. So don't pay too much attention to the particular variables used by the best model, of which there were hundreds very so similar out of millions to billions of models tried, using a score function that only approximates your goals and on finite data. So all those caveats mean really it's best to build a distribution of models and see how often certain variables appear in those distributions instead of a single best model. Also on some methods like decision trees or polynomial networks, the actual structure of the model will vary quite a bit from one run to the next if you change something little about the data. And this could be scary, but the estimates probably don't change. It's just how they get those estimates don't change much. So I make a distinction between apparent complexity and functional complexity. And again, I've got that in a journal article on our website. Finally, the best estimator is likely to be a bundle or ensemble of models. And let me give you a couple of examples here. A lot of times we'll judge a data mining model by a lift chart or an ROC chart or something like that that shows the trade-off. In this case, if you go 10%, you rank the customers so that the best customers or the worst customers, the ones you're looking for, are on the far left. And here, if you go 10% into that data, you get 20% of the return. Whereas you get 20% of return from the last 40% of the customers. So if you're doing a mailing or something, you can decide how far down this list to go, and the lift above the random line is a measure of your quality. Well, this is a decision tree, and the decision tree lumps a lot of people together. So everybody between these two decision points has an equivalent score. And you might need a finer cutting to decide where to cut off between those two. So ensembles not only give you better models, but they also provide more cutoff points. So here are models built on 80% of the training data, a different 80% on each one. And then they're merged together, just averaged, to create a model that's better than any of the individual ones, with the possible exception of this one over here. But it also has all these refined decision points so that you can cut it off and you have many more options for where the cutoff is to be drawn. So that's a nice side effect of model ensembles. Let me give an example from credit scoring where we built models. And five of the methods that we tried first were MARS, multiple adaptive regression splines, neural networks, polynomial networks, stepwise regression, which is close to the conventional technique, and bundled trees. Now, trees alone, their performance is way up here, decision trees. Decision trees are wonderful. They can handle missing data. They're interpretable, blah, 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 but they tend to do the worst. But when you bundle several trees together, they become competitive with other methods. And that's very exciting because of all the other properties that trees have. Still, they were the worst. Again, error is shown here. So MARS narrowly won out over neural networks and polynomial networks and so forth. Now, we tried two of them together at a time. And MARS and polynomial networks did better. And the distribution, as you can see, is getting better. And then We tried three at a time and four and five at a time. And there was an example. You can see here, it's not a guarantee. There was an example where three models averaged together did worse than any of the individual models. But as you can see, the trend is in the right direction. And that's shown on the next chart where we focus on the median and do a box plot. As you're bringing more models into combination, your expected error is going down. This is very exciting because you can be pretty well guaranteed that five individually good models are going to beat any of the individual ones. At least that's our experience in field after field. Now, we tried this going off to about a dozen methods, and it does have an asymptote. But there's another crop of ensemble methods that are in the works that seem to be taking it another step in pushing the performance. So where performance really leverages, ensembling is very useful. So we've focused on mistakes, talked about 10 of the most wide-reaching and most common mistakes. And now we're saying not only use tools you're familiar with, but start using these nonlinear tools that can make these mistakes at an even faster rate. You know, so how are we going to succeed? You know, there's a saying that success comes from experience, or good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So if you followed that, you'd say, well, we need to make as many mistakes as possible now, so that we'll have great judgment later, right? So hopefully I've given you some great hints on new mistakes to try if you haven't tried some of these, and that'll lead to good experience. But I'll just kind of end my presentation on a advice note. I first put this in for some graduate students at University of Virginia, so it's a little hokey, but hokey is Virginia Tech. Sorry, it was a little corny. A path to success. So the things that we find useful to us in our consulting work, number one, persistence. Repeatedly attacking the problem from different angles. A lot of brainstorming, and of course, reserving judgment during certain phases of the brainstorming so people feel free to think of crazy ideas, because that can often help. You have to automate the essential steps because things are in a loop, and you also don't want to make it painful to try certain ideas. I think our brain actually protects us from thinking of things that are too painful to implement. So the good news is these new tools that speed up the whole solution cycle actually lead to greater creativity because it frees that part of your brain that won't let you go there because of the pain involved. So, and obviously it's external check work. So one of the best things to do is to really have somebody rewarded for finding bad things in your work. It's painful to do, but it's much more reliable than yourself trying to find the mistake. Have a great attitude. There was just some very interesting research recently that showed people were trying to see if facial expressions for fear, greed, and so forth were universal across or cultural. And so they found they were virtually universal. But in the process, they also found something else, that in mimicking the facial expression for an emotion helped to actually generate the emotion. So that's, I'm extrapolating from that to say that a can-do attitude will actually have some effect on performance. It's not just window dressing. You have to work in a team. You got to cooperate with the business users. And it's often there's often somebody on the team who does not want the project to succeed. And unfortunately, they're usually the people who hold the data. So they only see danger in you actually looking at their data. Their data, it was a nice, you know, data pyramid for storage, and never, you know, it was a write-only memory. And now you're actually pulling stuff out of it, and you might find something like, you know, crazy. So you'll get this wonderful, you know, anti-cooperation from some of the members of the team. You've got to be aware of that and try to find something that makes it a win for them as well. And then humility. Obviously, we work in a lot of different fields, as you heard, and we have a lot to learn every time we start in a new field. And so, you know, soaking it up, being able to ask dumb questions. And people will let you ask dumb questions for maybe a month, but then you have to know their field. That's great. It's a lot of fun. That's what's fun about data mining, is learning this new stuff. But also humility in what we expect from the technology. As we can see, it's not a panacea. It still needs experts using it to do really well. So thank you all very much for having me. So I guess we have about 7 minutes.